the midst of consideration of legislation, as well as participation in oversight and the confirmation process, Senator Lee has harkened back to basic constitutional principles and respect for the structural Constitution more than I can remember any other senator doing. Is this having an impact? Well, the Senate by design is a place where things move very slowly, and so more time will be needed to determine whether Senator Lee is helping to pave the way for a lasting cultural shift in Congress. But I think we do know this. More individuals have been inspired to run for public office because of Senator Lee's work and efforts, precisely because they want to strengthen respect for the original Constitution in Washington. More Americans are talking about the Constitution because of Senator Lee, and more intelligently because of him, and members of the Senate, including some in his own caucus, are feeling just a little more pain and anxiety when they back efforts that lack a firm foundation in the founding principles, knowing that Senator Lee will be there at the barricades with a copy of his worn, dog-eared pocket Constitution. Welcome back, Senator Lee.
Thank you, Leonard. It's good to be among friends. It's also hard to believe that it has been 2 years since I was elected, almost 2 years since I took office. I'm glad that we'll be hearing from my good friend and soon-to-be colleague Ted Cruz in just a little while. I was very pleased when he was elected. I met him just a couple years ago, just after my election, and shortly before he announced his candidacy. I look forward to joining him and having him join our body. I especially look forward to no longer being the newest member of the Senate. It's been a rough transition. The security staff is finally recognizing me as a senator. I no longer get carded. I'm from Utah. I'm not used to getting carded. It's kind of a... you laugh, but it actually happened. It happened a lot. When I first got there, they would look at me like, what are you doing? These guys are very heavily armed, and I can't argue with them. And so I would produce my ID. I'll even show it to you. There's this little card. It says, United States Senator representing Utah, Mike Lee, expiration January 3rd, 2017. I don't know whether that's when I personally expire or... But we went through this little charade every so often when I had to go vote. After a while, I discovered a shortcut to it. This little lapel pin that I have on was given to me after I was sworn in. I came to call it my sorry senator pin, because when I got carted at the door to the Senate, I would point to it, and then they would say, sorry, senator, come on in. It works most of the time, not all the time. One time not too long ago, I was on the floor of the Senate. I had one hand gently resting on one of the desks, and one of the non-uniformed security staff personnel came up to me and said, will you please not lean on the senator's desk? I thought it was weird that he said, don't lean on your desk, but I respond well to authority. I said, I'm terribly sorry, it won't happen again. And he said, are you with the minority? And I said, well, what do you mean, on this vote or the next? I don't always vote with my party, but I do most of the time. No, do you work for the minority leader? I thought he was getting philosophical. I said, well, of course I support Mitch McConnell. He's our leader. Oh, are you part of the minority leader's staff? And then I realized he doesn't get it, so I pointed to the sorry senator pin. Blank stare. He had no idea what I meant. And at that point, I timidly said, I'm Senator Lee. What? My name is Mike Lee. I represent a state called Utah. It resembles a chair. It's square. He finally got it. At that point, all the color drained from his face, and he said, I'm terribly sorry. My name is Steve, if you want to report me. And then he ran for the door. I felt bad for Steve. I like Steve. I chased after him just to make sure he knew. No hard feelings. So every time I see Steve in the hall now, I say, hi, Steve, just so he knows there are no hard feelings. Only recently did it occur to me, his name's probably not Steve. So, when I started this year, 2012. I was looking forward to two things, two steps that I believed would help us fundamentally transform our government into that kind of government, or something more closely representing, resembling that kind of government that our founding fathers had envisioned for us. One of those events I knew would occur most likely sometime in June, probably toward the end of June, probably the last Thursday in June, which I quickly identified as June 28th. I was right. The other date that I recognized as potentially transformative of our government, the other date that I recognized that I thought would probably have a positive impact on the development of our constitutional system of government was November 6th. And I would just like to say at the outset that I want to thank Chief Justice Roberts for preparing me on June 28th for the disappointment I would feel on November 6th. I approached the court that day with a lot of anticipation. I had read all the briefs in that case. I had sat through 4 days of oral argument in that case. I had watched every movement, every eye twitch, every response to every question, every facial expression, and I'd listened closely to all the questions that they had asked. I thought I knew what the answer was going to be. A lot of it was wishful thinking. But I approached the courtroom that day with a lot of anticipation and a lot of hopefulness. As I took my seat in the bar section of the Supreme Court that day, I looked around. I looked to my right and slightly behind me, to this section of the courtroom where the law clerks sit. I remember just a few years earlier when I had served as a law clerk to Justice Alito, and I had sat in those chairs along with my friend Chris Paoella. And I remembered how much fun it was to watch the justices announce a decision that they'd been working on. We knew the result before the rest of the audience did. It was fun to watch their reactions. Then I looked to my right and a little bit to the front of me, and I saw that podium where I've seen so many lawyers stand over the years. Countless lawyers that I've seen stand there ever since I started attending Supreme Court arguments at the age of 10. It was an odd habit I picked up as a child. Many of those lawyers stood there shaking. You could see them, even from the back of the courtroom, shaking because they were so nervous. Their shaking got even more severe when they got a question that they didn't anticipate. Other lawyers had stood there as calm as if they were discussing the weather with a friend. My dad had been in the latter category. I had seen him argue in that court many times. Sometimes I thought he was almost too casual, but he was good at what he did. I could almost hear his voice resonating through the microphone as I thought back to the last time I saw him argue before that court in 1994 against a very worthy opposing counsel named John Roberts. That was a good day, an interesting day. As these thoughts were racing through my head, sooner or later the clock struck 10, and at the appointed hour, the gavel and clock operated almost as if in perfect unison. I heard the familiar pound of the gavel by the marshal, followed by the familiar incantation, "Oh yea, oh yea, oh yea, all persons having business before the Honorable the Supreme Court of the United States draw near and give their attention, for the court is now in session. God save the United States and this honorable court." Then these justices magically etherealized from behind these beautiful red velvet draperies. I listened to them start to announce the decisions. And, you know, true to form, the court held the most interesting case for the last case. And so the emotion in the room had reached a certain crescendo by the time it came time for the court to announce its ruling in NFIB versus Sebelius. I, along with most of the conservatives in the room, was elated when Chief Justice Roberts started announcing the opinion. I took that as a very, very good omen. I was even more elated as he launched into the constitutional analysis on the Commerce Clause. I was elated that for only the third time in the last 75 years, the Supreme Court was actually identifying something, anything, that was beyond Congress's immense power under the Commerce Clause. The tension in the room was palpable. You had conservatives in the room crying hot tears of joy. You had liberals in the room crying for exactly the opposite reason. And then all of a sudden, out of the clear blue, the winds shifted. The wind went out of the sails of conservatives and into the sails of the liberals, as the Chief Justice continued to explain to the dismay and to the shock of many of us, that even though Congress lacked the power to tell individual Americans that they have to buy health insurance, not just any kind of health insurance, but that kind of health insurance that Congress, in its infinite wisdom, deems necessary for every American to purchase, that that power could somehow be exercised under the taxing clause. This was a shocker. It was a shocker in part because the Chief Justice, in his hand-down announcement within the court, left something out. He left out a piece of the puzzle that I didn't get to see until after I left the courtroom. The piece of the puzzle was that the court simultaneously concluded that the penalty attached to the individual mandate was not a tax for purposes of the anti-injunction clause. But the court then counterintuitively went on to hold that it is a tax for constitutional purposes. The Chief Justice dealt with this shortly in about one paragraph, as I recall, saying, well, a tax for some purposes might not be a tax for other purposes, and that's the way it crumbles. You might have something that's not a tax for statutory purposes. Congress gets to decide that, but Congress doesn't get to decide whether it's a tax for constitutional purposes. He never quite explained why the standard was more rigid on one side than it was on the other, nor did he make any effort to explain why the court should be so willing to expand Congress's power. It went on. It continued to be a sort of roller coaster ride. He continued to tantalize and taunt and then torture conservatives by moving on to the next step of the analysis, going to the Medicaid expansion provisions, explaining to us that for the first time in its history, the court had actually identified something that Congress had done that violated the anti-coercion principle of the Constitution, that Congress had unconstitutionally coerced the states, and that this was not tolerable. Conservatives were again buoyed up, only to have the wind taken out of their sails yet again, with the court's very novel construction, with its very unprecedented remedy, a remedy that said, yeah, this is unconstitutional, but we're just going to order the government not to do that which the statute empowers the government to do. In other words, the Affordable Care Act specifically said that the secretary may withdraw the existing federal Medicaid revenue stream from the states that refuse to expand their Medicaid programs along the lines contemplated by the Affordable Care Act. It gave this power to the secretary. But that which Congress giveth, the Chief Justice taketh away. He did it with the stroke of a pen. And so what we saw that day was something very interesting. I struggled as I left the courtroom that day, starting to talk to reporters who had already gathered to try to get reactions from members of Congress who had reviewed the decision. I heard myself very quickly expressing a degree of optimism and even enthusiasm for this decision. After all, the court had drawn a line in the sand on the Commerce Clause. After all, the court had for the first time actually utilized the anti-coercion principle to declare something unconstitutional. But no sooner had those words left my mouth, no sooner had I expressed that thought, than I realized that it was really a Pyrrhic victory, or at least a very limited purpose victory. And I don't mean to demean or disparage or discount the fact that it was a good thing, that due to the efforts of great lawyers, lawyers like Randy Barnett, who are here with us today, we did get a limited purpose victory. But my point today is we can't overlook what we lost that day. We lost something very, very important. What we lost that day was the right that we have as Americans to live in a society in which our national government operates according to this separation of powers principles that's embedded in the Constitution. Now, this separation of powers is important because we can't have a court making laws. That law is entrusted only to our elected Congress. And yet, that's exactly what had happened that day. The Supreme Court rewrote the Affordable Care Act, not just once, but twice. First, in deciding that that which is a penalty, and that which, according to nearly a century's worth of precedent, was a penalty because of the fact that it imposed a financial exaction as a result of a failure to comply with an affirmative command of the law, was somehow a tax. That required a rewrite of the statute. That required an amendment of the statute. not just any rewrite or any amendment, but the kind of an amendment that Congress itself had been unable to achieve support to enact. I found it very significant that Congress had, in fact, tried to pass the individual mandate as a tax provision, tried to enforce it with a tax. They had failed to achieve the necessary votes. Why? Well, for reasons that we all understand, it's really, really difficult to get a new tax passed in Congress. That's what happened here. They couldn't get the votes. They couldn't get it passed. But it didn't matter at the end of the day because the Chief Justice rewrote it and turned a penalty into a tax. But it got even worse than that when he rewrote it yet again in order to erase power that the statute affirmatively granted to the Secretary of Health and Human Services. So we lost the opportunity to have our laws written by those of our own choosing, by men and women who stand accountable to the people at regular intervals every 2 years in the case of representatives, every 6 years in the case of senators. We can't overlook this fact. You see, because there are two kinds of constraints that we face in our constitutional system. One constraint, the one that we're often more inclined to focus on as lawyers, is the judicial constraint. If Congress does something, if that something is repugnant to the Constitution, then the court is supposed to step in and invalidate it. The court is supposed to serve as a check. The court can't serve that function if, at the end of the day, it's unwilling to exercise that power. And so the judicial check was removed in this case. The court, faced with constitutional defects, overcame those defects by rewriting the statute. But it did so in a way that makes matters worse by virtue of the fact that it got rid of the second kind of check, the political check. You see, because after this ruling, it's no longer a death knell. If you can't get legislation passed in a manner that's constitutional, don't worry about it because the court will rewrite it. So the court will take care of both the judicial backstop and the political backstop as well. This isn't okay. It's not okay, especially because this will in turn further facilitate the erosion of another of the Constitution's most important principles, that of federalism. The notion that the power of the federal government is limited, that the powers of Congress are few and defined and those reserved to the states are numerous and indefinite. So this, at the end of the day, is not something that we can embrace and accept as freedom-loving Americans, certainly not as judicial conservatives. This is not something that I think we should praise. I want to make very clear that I have nothing but profound professional respect for Chief Justice Roberts. I think he's a good and decent man, and I think for the most part he's been an outstanding jurist throughout the course of his career. But make no mistake, this was a sharp aberration from that professional standard that he had established early in his career. I hope and I expect that this will prove to be just that, an aberration, and that it will not be something that we can expect more of in the future. You see, because otherwise, if this is something that we can expect more of in the future, then we will have found ourselves not only not benefiting from any limitations established by the NFIB versus Sebelius decision, we'll find ourselves with a bigger and bigger government, one facing more and more burdens as a result of its own inability to fund its own operations. Ultimately, the rule of law requires more than that. Now, when we look back at the reaction that some in our community had to that decision, there were some who immediately praised it. There were some, even self-professed conservatives, who immediately said, this was a brilliant decision. This was a masterminded decision because, you see, he preserved the institutional credibility of the court. He preserved his power of the as the Chief Justice to look out for the court's own institutional interests. He did that by showing to the public that he wasn't partisan, that he wasn't going to take one side or the other, that he was going to chart his own middle ground. He was going to cut it right down the middle. This isn't a good justification, even though a lot of self-professed conservatives claimed it to be such. It isn't one because we have to remember that jurists take an oath. They take an oath to decide each case objectively on the basis of the law and the facts before them. And they'll decide that case regardless of how they think the public might react to it. And so looking out for the institutional credibility of the court, to the extent that means the public's opinion of the court is not only not a good justification for changing your opinion, for altering your judicial analysis, it's a particularly pernicious evil within the judicial system. It's not something that we can respect. To the extent that this was just an idea of let's split the decision so that it is even-handed because that's fair, the Chief Justice, I don't think, believes that that's a good thing. I don't think any of us think that that's a good thing. We have to remember that in what became Solomon's most famous case, his purpose was never to apply the law in the fashion that he prescribed. He was on a fact-finding mission. His only objective in suggesting that they split the baby was not, in fact, to split the baby. The law didn't require it. It certainly wouldn't have even allowed it. And had he undertaken that effort, neither party would have gone home happy. What he did in that case was simply to uncover the truth. It was never intended to result in the splitting of the baby. Unfortunately, in this case, what we were left with was an attempt, I believe, by a court that was determined to give each side some of what it wanted. But sometimes when jurists attempt to do that and consider that an end unto itself, a lot of harm results, just as harm would have resulted in Solomon's most famous case. We have before us a number of challenges as a nation. I think those challenges can either be made easier or more difficult as a result of our willingness and our ability to communicate the reasons why it's so important that we live under a government that recognizes some restraints on its own power, that we recognize that each branch of government has its own power and it shouldn't step on any other branch's power. And we've also got to stand up for the principle that not every power should be exercised at the national level. The more we stand for these principles, unpopular as they may be, difficult to explain as they may be, I tend to believe that our best days really will be ahead of us as Americans. You see, Americans are smart. Americans are able to recognize truth. Truth resonates with the American people. But in order for it to resonate, it has to come from us. We have to speak it. We have to identify it. And we have to identify error where we see error. This is one instance where error has occurred, and I hope that we won't ever shrink from the task of identifying error when it arises, especially when it jeopardizes the health, the vitality of our great God-given constitutional system. Thank you very much.
Two questions, maybe.
Good afternoon, Senator Lee. Thank you so much. The third time I've heard you speak here, and you're ever more inspiring every time. If you go back and look at Chief Justice Roberts' confirmation hearings, he was asked many times about his theory of restraint and deference. He was never asked to articulate his theory of limited government. Is there something the Judiciary Committee could do in the future to avoid perhaps the kind of restraint we got, the kind of blind restraint, I would say, we got in the Obamacare decision?
Yes, I'm glad you asked that question. This is something that I bring up regularly. In my short, almost 2 years in the Senate, we, of course, have yet to process any Supreme Court nominees, but, you know, we process with some regularity lower court judges. And it doesn't matter whether they're district judges or circuit judges, I make a practice of asking them what their views are on the enumerated powers doctrine. And I very frequently will ask them to identify, even if it requires some degree of speculation, what, if anything, falls outside of Congress's power under the Commerce Clause. And make it a little bit more difficult for them by telling them that they can't identify Lopez or Morrison. And now I'll add to that NFIB. as the basis of their theory that something falls outside the government's power. You'd find it quite interesting to watch some of the responses. A lot of them look as if I've asked them to insult their mother or something like that. Some of them look at me as if I've asked them to derive pi to the 800th decimal from memory. But, you know, it is an important question, and it's a question that I think needs to be asked a lot more often. I also think it's interesting to watch what happens when that question is asked at the Supreme Court. I thought it was interesting to watch variations of that question be asked during the NFIB arguments and to listen to the Solicitor General hem and haw and ultimately not come up with anything that is beyond Congress's power.
Senator, you were perhaps most forceful in your response to President Obama's so-called recent appointments of three individuals to a board and to head of CFIB. After some sort of initial votes no on all of his nominees, you voted yes on some of them that came up later on. And so I was wondering, one, has there been some sort of assurances given that that will not repeat and that's why you've been perhaps more flexible later on? And two, will there be a similarly forceful response either from you or your colleagues or both of you should Senator Reid decide to proceed and change the filibuster rule at the beginning of, 113th Congress?
Okay. So first, as to the recess appointments issue, this was an important issue for me. When President Obama made four appointments that he identified as recess appointments on January 4th, 2012, three to the NLRB and one being Richard Cordray to head Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, he broke with precedent. You know, people from both parties have been fond of responding to this by saying, look, every president, or nearly every president, has made recess appointments. The other party always complains. Get over it. Grow up. But those who say that overlook something very important. This one was unprecedented, because this, as far as I've been able to ascertain through my research, it's the first time, the only time in history, when any president has purported to exercise the recess appointment power at a time when the Senate, according to its own rules, was not in recess. It's significant, in fact, that just 24 hours before these appointments were made, on January 3rd, 2012, the Senate had held its opening convening session of session two of the 112th Congress. Congresses generally consist of two sessions, session one being the first year, session two being the second year. So the Senate had just convened in its inaugural session of the second session 24 hours earlier. And according to the Senate's own rules, according to time-honored precedent and tradition, we were not adjourned for purposes relevant to the recess appointments clause. And so that's why I signaled my displeasure at this. I had to think of something in order to keep it in the news, because I think it's important that people continue to talk about it. So I voted no on a number of judicial appointments since then, after that point. Toward the end of the year, I lifted my categorical no vote policy only because the Senate Republican Conference had, by that point, in my opinion, adequately responded to what the president did by invoking the Leahy-Thurmond rule, refusing to process additional judicial nominees within a certain category beyond that point. So I regarded that as a sufficient response. I had said at the outset that until such time as my party responds or until I get some kind of assurance from the president this won't happen again, I'm going to continue to vote no. As to the second part of your question, if Harry Reid undertakes this very nuclear option of tinkering with the filibuster rule, if, as we anticipate, he tries to shut down the process of cloture votes on motions to proceed, we will regard that as a threat to the institution and a threat to our system of rules, or a threat to our system that has made the Senate supposedly the greatest deliberative legislative body in the world. And there will be a strong and proportional response. I can't tell you exactly what that will be yet, in part because we don't know what form Harry Reid's efforts might take. Nor are we absolutely certain that he's going to do it yet. We're trying to convince him that it's not in his interest to do it. But rest assured, we're not going to take kindly to that.